I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. Well, we're back this week, week 8 of Disasters Deconstructed, and we are bringing you some more conversation from our interview with JC Gaillard about capacities.
So last week, in the first part of our episodes on capacities, JC has really explained what is the difference of between vulnerability and capacity, and that's and why they're not two ends of the same spectrum. And also, I think he unpacked pretty well the whole idea behind capacity and where it came from in the 1980s. He also touched upon the issues of power and balancing power. And this is what JC will be talking more about in the second part of this episode on capacities.
So let's get back into it.
Enhancing capacities are still, I think, and I'm thinking just live at the moment here on this, still less disrupting than addressing the cultural norms and values that may lead some people to be more vulnerable than others. Mm-hmm. Think of the caste system in India, which one could say underpins some people's vulnerability more than others. Who are we outsider to challenge the caste system as something bad? And I'm not saying if the challenge to the system comes from the inside, from locals, then that's perfectly fine, right? But we outsider Westerners, for example, who are we to say that? We need to challenge that. We need to empower the lower castes. This is difficult. I think enhancing capacities doesn't require to ask those big questions, or at least not to that extent, which makes it probably, or at least I've never been confronted to that situation. It's probably less challenging and less disrupting, less puzzling for a Westerner working in a non-Western environment. Would you agree with that?
I haven't thought too much about the difficulty of intervening in something that I, based on my perspective, think is unjust or unfair, but that's based on being an outsider, you know?
And that's an elephant in the room. Yeah. We all talk about inclusion, right? Participation, but is inclusion or participation actually ethical?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that we shouldn't, right, foster inclusion and participation. And it's a difficult, it's a classic humanitarian dilemma, right? How do you feed the most vulnerable women and children in a very patriarchal society when you know that you have to both respect culture and go for the most marginalized and the most in need? I mean, because at the same time, we are told, okay, we have to respect culture, right? So it's very difficult. And we were going beyond the topic here, but I think this is a big elephant in the room that affects the discussion capacities as much as affects everything we do, and we're not putting much thinking about it. And it's a bit of taboo sometimes.
Been working in Australia for 5 years and now in US, and I think in these environments, people and communities are organized in very different ways, right? So, and families are organized in different ways, and a lot of the culture in these countries is all based around, you know, personal freedoms and kind of small family units and accumulating and protecting a small unit, right? And I think that kind of, so for me, looking at other contexts, It's very easy for me to go to a context which has more of a sharing culture and a larger social network of kind of belonging, a larger group identity, and kind of glorify that and think everything must be fine in that culture, and it must be better than where I where I am a local, because in my local context I feel like, you know, the culture is kind of selfish and very individualistic. So it's very difficult for us to speak to cultures outside of our own, right?
And this is where we have to be very careful, because the three of us, for example, advocate for or try to challenge the Western hegemony in terms of science, in terms of approaches to DRR. But at the same time, and me first, call for inclusion, call for participation, and there's an epistemological tension here, right? Because inclusion is a very Western concept. So we have to be very, very careful about how we pitch our different discourses and make sure they all come together. And it's it's very, very challenging. I mean, it challenges our very own kind of beliefs, I think. The concept of capacities, I mean, it's very Western. I mean, it's a Latin concept again, like vulnerability, resilience, and blah, blah, blah. In many contexts, people won't label these capacities. Even academics, some have called these somehow subculture, but the talking about the very concept of capacities, having this podcast, is building upon a Western concept.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very, very careful to be in sync with what we say.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we don't even question this, you know, and that is very often the problem, that many of the researchers and practitioners, we, as you said, you know, what we do is very normative, and we don't ask ourselves this question. So I guess, you know, we need to challenge the future generations thinking a little bit, to just start kind of ponder about this a little bit more, rather than take for granted what's written in the text. JC, we should make the role of capacity more prominent in a risk equation, so to say, you know.
I think we need to reemphasize where the concept comes from, it's like for vulnerability, I think there was explicitly or not, there was a political dimension to it. I mean, it was again to show that people have resources, they're not helpless, and they should participate. I mean, interestingly, this the concept of capacities was supporting the whole discourse around participation in the 80s, right? It was to show that we need to build upon people because they're not helpless. They have these capacities. So they should lead whatever initiatives towards reducing disaster risk. So you can't disconnect the discourse on capacities from the discourse on participation. And the discourse on participation is highly political. It's been, again, emptied of its political essence, but participation is about power. It's recognized. It's about challenging power relations, and it's recognizing the power of the locals, and the power of the locals or is built on these capacities. They have the ability, they have the resources, they have the skills, they have the knowledge to make decision, well informed decision by themselves to inform the others. It's a highly political thing. We need to go beyond just the. Okay, what kind of resources, what kind of knowledge? It's not a list of things, right? When we suggested this this circle thing with the livelihood resources into it, this is just an academic kind of artifact to pull things on a piece of paper. There's a whole political argument behind it, and I think we need to reclaim that. And we need many practitioners to acknowledge that. And many do. I mean, and my own practice in the Philippines, where the field of NGO is highly politicized, it's politically charged. This is an obvious thing, but it's not the case in many other countries and many other places in the world. In the West, in the South, in the North, in the East, however we chop the world into different regions, it doesn't matter. We need to recapture this political dimension. We don't want to emphasize capacities just for the sake of filling in boxes in VCA matrices, mm-hmm. right?
So JC, it's really interesting to try to make this connection to political action, and I think obviously the pooling of capacities and building of capacity helps to connect a community in a way that it can become more active or it can become energized. Do you see a way that helps to connect to the other side of this equation, you know, where we talk about vulnerability and root causes of vulnerability? Do you think that more connected communities and more connected people can mobilize to actually address root cause issues?
I don't think they're the two ends of the same spectrum. So you may strengthen capacities and still have your root causes of vulnerability standing.
Yeah.
You may have common dimensions to it.
Is it important to connect those commonalities? I mean, otherwise, does capacity building exercises or programs or processes or objectives or whatever way you want to approach it, does that become another exercise in putting a band-aid on the problem?
To me, this is a band-aid. This is the short-term easy solution. But this is still important. This is important. What I'm trying to say is that we need to look at both in tandem. We can't mm-hmm. look at both in silos. I mean, because in context, people don't tick boxes. So I have these capacities, I have these vulnerabilities, right? It's all embedded, and people don't label these things. So it's they know they resort to those particular skills or knowledge or resources because they are vulnerable. So capacities are very good for coping, for example. Coping with a situation that has been generated by processes of vulnerabilization, right?
Yeah.
So you can't look at them in silos. They need to come together. And this is a good thing somehow of the VCA. The VCA pulls them together. What I struggle with in the VCA is the normative process, the normative way it's been rolled out everywhere in the same way. It's not the overall kind of framework. And Anderson and Woodrow's book in 1989 is fantastic. But people have taken it as a template, which is not. This is my concern.
I'm just interested in thinking more about this and how these efforts around capacity or even around resilience can be used to mobilize communities to actually get involved in structural change in society. So, and that would be a way of kind of connecting these different areas of study, you know.
So we've come to the end of our discussion with JC Gaillard. We were talking about capacities and capacity, and we never actually got around to clarifying the difference between the two. So I would direct you to a recent article by JC and his colleagues in Natural Hazards, and the title is People's Capacities in Facing Hazards and Disasters, an Overview. And this article really differentiates between the two, and it's a really enlightening read on this topic for sure. So go into the show notes and check out that article. So I think today we had a really fascinating discussion. Thanks again to JC for joining Ksenia and I just wanted to maybe reflect on some of the things we discussed, since I have a bit of time. I think we're only at about, you know, less than 20 minutes now. So I have a few things I wanted to maybe talk about. One of the things that really stood out to me was this question as to whether it's more important to try to reduce vulnerability or to enhance capacity. And JC was talking about how it's often much easier for organizations that are working in the field through their programming to actually address the capacity issue. So, like, I think the thing that we were getting at was that really it's not an either or, but it is important to look at who is asking this question and what their influence is, what their ability is, what their organization or there's an individual are actually able to change, and that it does require a joint effort. So it's not that everybody needs to be trying to enhance capacities, or that everyone needs to be trying to tackle root causes and solve, you know, structural systemic problems in society, because not everybody or every organization has the same amount of influence, the same power. And I think we alluded to that a couple of times in the discussion, that this really is a conversation we need to have in the context of power dynamics, and to recognize that not everybody has the same answer to that question as to whether it's more important to focus on vulnerability or capacity. And of course, as JC mentioned, it's not a continuum. It's not, these things are not the opposites of each other. So there really isn't any singular way to address disaster risk. There's no one person or organization that's responsible for it. And it is something that we need to think of as a collective effort. We need people at all levels to participate. Another thing I wanted to mention, and I've put it in the show notes, was a video that is on YouTube of JC talking at the Ignite stage in Sendai at the UN conference, which was to do with disasters, called WCDRR. And he talked about the issue of homelessness and disaster risk. And he really explained some of these issues around vulnerability and capacities in an interesting way. So I'd encourage you to go to YouTube, go to the show notes and find that video, check it out. He talked about the importance of power and resources not being shared equity in society, and that these are really the root causes of the vulnerability of the homeless population. And that these things were causing social marginalization. They were causing lack of political voice. But at the same time as this homeless population was being marginalized and denied a voice, they were also developing certain capacities and strengths. And these capacities that they had developed seemed to reflect the context of their life and the context that of problems that they had been exposed to and had to deal with. And so they developed very particular knowledge and skills and resources. So I think that's really quite a critical part of this conversation. And then I also wanted to just reflect on the fact that we need different key players to be involved in both enhancing capacities and reducing vulnerability, addressing root causes of risk in society. And they aren't always going to be the same players. JC was saying from his experience that local organizations in the community and international NGOs are often much better placed to use their position to enhance capacities rather than look at how to reduce vulnerability. So the problem that I'm seeing is who is responsible for addressing root causes in society? If we aren't going to be able, or it's going to be too hard to look at that at a local level, and we're going to focus on building capacities, which, as we've discussed in these two episodes, is a smart thing to do when we have limited resources and limited time to actually try to enact some sort of change. But who is responsible for reducing risk by dealing with the root causes, by trying to change policy, trying to change society? Last week, I was at the natural hazard workshop in Colorado, which was fascinating. And I realized something when I was just reflecting on some of the talks. And that was that powerful organizations that should be confronting injustice and inequality and some of these systemic root causes of risk creation in our society, they actually want to do capacity building stuff. They want to integrate some of these things that we've talked about in these two episodes that are easier to do, that are seen as more positive. And the other thing I noticed was that these same organizations actually have the position and the power to make a difference in terms of addressing root causes. And they also have a seat at the table of decision making. But what I found listening to the representatives of some of these organizations that hold this kind of power in society and decision making influence is that they are trying so hard to keep any talk of system change off of the table. And that really frustrated me when I listened to some people talking in this way and talking about kind of censoring our language to make sure that we all can cooperate and be nice to each other. Well, the way I feel about it is that there's some issues in society where we just have to stand up and say, no, this is wrong, and we're not going to take it anymore. So those who have the power to change in our society won't listen to us. How are we supposed to behave? As citizens, as scientists, whatever. How are we supposed to behave? What language are we supposed to use to express our discontent? And how do we resist if we want to collaborate across all levels? Of course we do. We had this interesting discussion on Twitter as well over the past few days about the necessity of having people who are acting sort of as double agents, who are almost infiltrating organizations that have that power and influence. As individuals, they believe in equity. They believe in social justice. They want to work within the system, within that power structure, to actually change it. And there has to be a place for those individuals. And I look at the position of academics in society. And for many of us, it feels like a kind of double agent identity where we're trying to change things that we are a part of and that we benefit from. So I'd love to hear what any of you think about some of these issues, about how we need to proceed in this time where we have such high concentration of power and influence among organizations and among people that don't necessarily look out for the interests of most people in our society. And I just wonder what some of you have to share about how do we fight back against this and how do we effect change in our organizations and in our communities and in our culture. Like, what sort of ideas do you all have about this? We would love to hear, we'd love to discuss, and we'd love to know about any ideas for future topics for the podcast. As always, thanks for listening. Check us out on Twitter at DisastersDecon and also on Instagram. And we will see you next week.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Ksenia, for inviting me. It was great to talk to you and discuss those issues. Thank you all as well for listening. You've been listening to Ksenia, Jason, and me, JC. On Disasters Deconstructed Podcast.